I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Should be a great hour coming up. This hour, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, Volume 3, 1939 to 1962. Blanche Wiesen-Cook is our guest, and this is Blanche's completion of her examination of the very large life of Eleanor Roosevelt. She has spent 25 years on this biography, Volume 1, published in 1992, Volume 2 in 1999. Blanche is a professor of history at John Jay College and the Graduate Center of SUNY, and she is with us this hour to talk about, well, this large life. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. And Blanche, thank you ever so much for having done this wonderful series of books. I haven't read one and two yet, but after most of three, I'm going to climb back into one.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, I think you'll like them, Kat.
Yes.
I think you really will.
Yes. Oh, there is no doubt about that. I love number three. And I would imagine this was in number one or number two, but every now and then you have to make reference to earlier parts of her life to figure out how she became who she was. These 3 years, could we start with this when she went to Allenswood Academy in England and she was discovered for the bright, wonderful person that she was, even though she had been treated quite the opposite when she was very young?
Well, it really, her years at the wonderful Allenswood School in England, where she studied under the great educator Marie Souvestre, who was also, you know, many of the British leaders, mentors, the Allenswood crowd, very well known. And Marie Souvestre recognized Eleanor Roosevelt's talents, her brilliance, her ability to connect with people, and she really, you know, she encouraged her to become herself, to be bold, to be honest, to take vigorous stands, and never to be afraid. And Eleanor Roosevelt's lifetime motto was, courage can be as contagious as fear.
Oh, you have her voice too, Blanche. Good for you. That's great. And here was a young girl whose mother called her Granny, who paid no attention to her. She adored her father, but he was an alcoholic and died when she was very young. She had such a sad childhood, didn't she?
She really did. And the thing about Eleanor Roosevelt is that she identified with people in want, in need, mm-hmm. in trouble. And the thing about Eleanor Roosevelt and why she's so important for our lifetime is she believed that government existed for only one reason, to make life better for people in want, in need, in trouble, to make life better for all people. And she identified with people in want, in need, in trouble, people just like her own family. And at this point, we know a lot about alcoholism, the family disease.
Right.
You know, her father died when he was 34. Eleanor Roosevelt was 8 when her mother died, who essentially turned her face to the wall and gave up. Her father died when she was 10. And imagine how much you have to drink to die at the age of 34, and what a mess their life had been, which is in Volume 1. And then her aunts and grandmother sent her away to school in England, where they had gone, where her aunts had gone. And she was saved by this, you know, really brilliant French scholar, Marie Souvestre, S-O-U-V-E-S-T-R-E, and I always spell it out for my students because there are many women in this book who still do not have biographies, and the great educator Marie Souvestre is one of them.
Well, that's your next project, although you can take a break.
It's not my next project, but it should be somebody's next project.
And it kind of weaves in, as is frequently the case, if alcoholism runs in your family. I found it interesting that you made reference to her years when she had to deal with alcoholism in her family when Winston Churchill came to the White House and started drinking when he got up in the morning.
Right, right. And she thought he was a terrible influence on her husband. And, you know, she really worried about people who drank as much as Winston Churchill did. She didn't think they were in control. And at some point, went much later after the war, he says to her, "You don't really approve of me, do you?" And of course, she really didn't.
Right. No, she didn't. I guess I hadn't realized how tough all of those years were. Her indefatigable fighting for racial justice, for refugees, that these were huge fights, and the New Deal wasn't going down very smoothly with a lot of people who really hated the thing. The names that the Roosevelts were called, how hard it was to achieve racial justice, how she had to really carry on her own fight, even though it wasn't completely shared by her husband, because he had to deal with the politics of everything.
That's right. I mean, the echoes of that moment and this moment are so stark.
Yes, yes.
So that FDR was a juggler, and he had to deal with this completely racist, dominated Congress, dominated by the Democrats, who were then the Dixiecrats. And he could not have gotten some of the New Deal legislation through that he got through if it was in any way integrated. So Social Security, for example, didn't cover farm workers, didn't cover domestic workers, didn't cover whole categories of workers, including women, like teachers, for many years, the 1935 Social Security Act. And folks don't know that, but it's in my book, because Eleanor Roosevelt was really, you know, fighting for more.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what a fighter she was on so many fronts, wasn't she?
Right.
I guess I didn't even realize the battle that took place in FDR's silence on lynching in the country. 1939, a bill that she championed, we had to have an anti-lynching law, and there was controversy about it in 1939, for heaven's sake?
And it never passed.
I know. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it is.
What was going on? Why? Why?
Well, what's going on, you know, why is Black Lives Matter so important today? Because people are shot in the back for traffic stops. It's really quite astonishing.
It is astonishing.
And if you look at the prison industrial complex, who's in prison and what they're in prison for, it's really an atrocity. And Eleanor Roosevelt really was opposed to prison. Long before Angela Davis said we should close prisons down and have other, you know, we should have education for all, we should have therapy for all, we should have work for all, Eleanor Roosevelt was calling for that.
Mm-hmm.
And when she would go to women's prisons, she'd visit many women's prisons all over the country, and she would write to her friends and say to them, "I could have been any one of the women on the inside." And I always thought that meant she, too, could have killed her husband.
Well, let's talk about her husband for a moment. In 1918, she discovers this affair that her secretary is having She is able, although it leads her to, and I want you to tell us about some of the depression. She has suffered from that earlier in her life, too, but what she did when she learned that, and also how she was able to, you write that she forged with FDR one of history's most powerful and enduring partnerships. She understood his needs. She forgave his own transgressions and buried her jealousies, which seems to me to have been a very hard thing to do. So before we get to the partnership that they were able to form and how she forgave him what he did, let's talk about that earlier thing that I had mentioned. What was it that made her able to forgive him, and how did she deal with her own devastation about this affair?
Well, she really was devastated, and she offered him a divorce, and you know, but it would have been the end of his political career, which she believed in, and so they forged this partnership, and it gave her the freedom to do the many things she wanted to do, and I think, you know, their parallel lives is a really fascinating story of parallel lives. She trusted him, she admired him, and she forgave him. And he trusted her. He never silenced her. You know, if she could build a movement, he would do it. And then there were some things that he couldn't do, and she had to be silent, especially during the war. But their parallel lives is very interesting. There are people in her life who are very important to her, So she has her home at Val Kill with Marion Dickerman and Nancy Cook. That's sort of over in Volume 2. But then there's Earl Miller, who is one of her great steadies, and there's Lorena Hickok, who is very important to her and probably a lover until about 1936. And then she's kind of a serial romantic, and she understands his needs for different women. She accepts his Missy LeHand, who lives in the White House and is really a junior wife. And she is very close to Missy LeHand, very grateful to Missy LeHand for her role in FDR's life. You know, she enjoys the party. She's the, you know, she's the social partner, and Eleanor Roosevelt wants no part of that and doesn't have to have any part of it because Missy LeHand is the other live-in junior wife.
Mm-hmm. She had so many. I mean, it's hard to keep track in your book of all the friendships she had. She had all these people who were all over the country and very, very deep and rejuvenating relationships for however long they lasted. There would be new people moving in.
Right. But you mean for Eleanor Roosevelt?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And then Joe Lash and, you know, Trudeau become very important to her later in life, and her last great friendship is with her physician friend, David Gurevich, and his wife, Edna. And they, too, begin to live together in a house they buy together. And it's really quite a remarkable story.
Mm-hmm. And how close was she to Adlai Stevenson?
She was a very great fan of Adlai Stevenson. She supported him in 52 and then again in 56. But she was a little disappointed by Adlai Stevenson on racial issues, and so, but they're not very close. They are, you know, politically close.
Mm-hmm. Well, she must have been disappointed in a whole lot of people when it came to racial issues.
Yes, but there were also people, especially the young people, like the folks around the American Youth Committee. You know, Joe Lash and Trudeau Lash, Gertrude, one of the great heroes of this book, and again, there's no work about her, is Gertrude von Adam Pratt Lash, who becomes Trudeau Lash, marries Joe Lash in 1944, and she's part of the anti-Hitler Friends of German Freedom underground, and she's really responsible for the rescue operation, the Varian Fry rescue operation, and they are the great anti-racist, the great unity builders, and very important to Eleanor Roosevelt's sense of hope in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But Trudeau, Joe and Trudeau were friends of mine, and really Joe was responsible for this book because I'm a military historian by origin.
Oh.
And I was working on my Eisenhower book in Abilene, Kansas, which was a dry town, and got friends with the local sheriff who had single malt and guns, and we would shoot guns at the end of the day with the library closed, and
oh my goodness,
drink his single malt, and friends would send me books to review, and I got this book on Lorena Hickok by a woman who couldn't stand the possibility that there really was love between Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a very nasty review of the Doris Faber book, and then when I got back to New York and Eisenhower was published, my Eisenhower book was published, I called Joe and I said, "What's up with you not having Hick in any of your books?" And he said, "Well, I hated her. Let's have dinner." And Joe Lash had blurred my Crystal Eastman book. This is a book that should stay in print forever, and you get to be friends with people who blurb your books that way. So we had dinner, and he explained that he and Trudeau hated Hick because she was a racist and a bigot, mm-hmm. an anti-Semite, really. Mm-hmm. And then he said, "Why don't you do it?" And I said, "The goddess forgive me." I said, "Don't be ridiculous. I'm a military historian. I do hard history." And he said, "You know, you're wrong." And he took me up to Hyde Park to the Roosevelt Library. And I saw that he was the good son. Anything Eleanor Roosevelt wanted him to deal with, he dealt with. Anything she didn't want him to deal with, he didn't. She said, "I don't believe it. I don't care about power." and he wrote that. And then I knew I had a story. And this is 1982, so I thought I could finish it by her centennial in 1984.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was my intention, but it
25
didn't work out
years
that
later,
work.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it amazing that somebody has lived such a huge life that you have three volumes, and you probably could do another volume almost.
I mean,
it's just extraordinary.
Yeah. And the Human Rights Years is the epilogue of my book, Her Legacy, and because I decided, you know, I'm not going to do another volume. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, as Joe always said, Eleanor Roosevelt is infinite, and there's more to do.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the issue of refugees, because she had a hard time persuading people that we needed to take people in, and she knew of the suffering of, you know, Polish refugees. Hitler had taken over Czechoslovakia. There were people from Spain who were refugees. There were a lot of refugees, and you cite this, which I think is interesting. 94% of Americans disapproved of Nazi policies regarding Jews, 97% regarding Catholics, but only 83% wanted, but a complete 83%, that's a lot, wanted nothing done to assist them. So this desire, she saw the suffering, she felt the suffering, and she did everything that she could do to get people to take people in, but it was so hard. Why?
Well, I think we don't realize how much bigotry and anti-Semitism existed in the United States. And I think we see some of that today. But there are now over 65 million refugees today.
Wow.
And folks don't want them to come into this country. And then there were millions of refugees, and folks didn't want them into this country. And so there was propaganda that they were going to be communists, or they were going to be un-Americans, or they were going to be, you know, revolutionaries. Now we say terrorists, then we said communists.
Right.
But there was really only one haven. And Ruth Gruber, who just died at the age of 105 last week, was the real hero, a very great journalist and freedom fighter, Ruth Gruber, who's written about 18 books. And she's in this book. And the one haven in Oswego is detailed in this book, but there's only one. And it's because Henry Morgenthau, in 1944, says we have to bypass the State Department, which is doing nothing to help refugees at all. In fact, the State Department was committed to delay, and not let any refugees in. And it's Henry Morgenthau, in 1944, who stops that. But it's really one of the themes in the book, really, is why didn't FDR fire this really dreadful bigot named Breckinridge Long? And Breckinridge Long is, he puts him in charge. FDR puts Breckinridge Long in charge of almost three quarters of the divisions of the State Department, in charge of everything relating to refugees. And he doesn't fire him. And that's really a big puzzle. And at one point, Eleanor Roosevelt protests and says, but Franklin, you know he's a fascist. And FDR says, well, okay, but don't use that word. Still doesn't fire him.
Yeah.
And it's not until 1944 and the Emergency Rescue Committee really gets to work, and the refugees, 1,000, are brought in to this one place in Oswego called, which is Haven.
And she speaks out, which is unusual. For the first time ever, she endorsed a piece of legislation you write about, the Wagner-Rogers bill?
Yes, to bring in children, to bring in 20,000 children.
And what happened to that bill?
Well, that bill gets destroyed because it was supposed to be in addition to refugees, not instead of, and Congress says, okay, we'll let 20,000 children in, but that will count as the immigrants. And then Wagner just says, okay, no, I didn't want that to happen. And the bill never passes.
Somebody made the comment, 20,000 children and grow up to be 20,000 adults, darn it.
Right, nits make lice.
Yeah.
Right, that's the expression. So there'll be 20,000 ugly adults.
Ugly adults.
Nits make lice. That's the expression.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Blanche, and here's how you reach our conversation. We're talking about Eleanor Roosevelt, and our guest is just finished Volume 3. She spent 25 years working on the three-volume biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. This one is Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, so it's 1939 to 1962. Blanche Wiesen-Cook is with us. She's a distinguished professor of history at John Jay College and Graduate Center, City University of New York. She is also author of The Declassified Eisenhower and Crystal Eastman on Women and Revolution. Eleanor Roosevelt, Volume 1, was a winner of the L.A. Times Book Prize, and both volumes, of course, were New York Times bestsellers, as this one is as well. Here's how you reach our conversation. Did I give you the number? It's 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter at K Dunn Show, and lines are open for you. This is the Ideas Network. Let's take your phone calls concerning Eleanor Roosevelt this hour, 800-486-8655. We start our calls with Albert in Eau Claire. Hello, Albert.
Good afternoon.
Wow. Good afternoon, Albert. Can't hear you very well. Can you get closer? There you go.
I'm sorry.
There we go.
Blanche, I have a question for you, and do you know who was Eleanor's beautician when she was in office?
I don't know who her beautician was. I do know that she went to have her nails and her hair done regularly, about once a
week. Yes. Hmm. My father's cousin was Eleanor Roosevelt's beautician. I kid you not.
What was her name?
Her first name was Ann Lavorata. Now, she may have used her married name of Heinrich, but she was married only for a few months, so she didn't really keep that name. But I don't know if there's any record of her.
Do you know, did you get any stories? Because usually people talk to their hairdressers. Do you have stories that the family has passed down, Albert?
I asked her about that. And the last time I visited her, she used to live in Palm Springs, California.
Right.
The last time I was able to get a hold of her was shortly, they had a large earthquake in Palm Springs, and her apartment building was damaged.
Oh.
They moved her out, and I never heard from her again.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Albert, how do you spell Lavorel? Because I can check with the FDR Library.
Oh.
The last name is L as in, L-A-V as in Victor, O-R-A-T-A.
O-R-A-E?
A-T-A.
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 Apple, Thomas, Apple.
Lavorati.
Yeah.
Lavorata. Yeah.
Lavorata. O-L-A-V-O-R-A-T-A.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
All right, Albert, we'll put you on hold. We'll have Zeb talk to you so he can get your information number, because Blanche is very kindly looking this up.
Well, if you could, I won't look it up now, but.
No, I understand. But down the road.
Yeah.
So we'll get an email address.
If you could get Albert's, I could.
Email address for Albert. We're on, Zeb?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Once a researcher, always a researcher,
yeah,
right?
That's
you just never know what you're going to be talking about next. I want to spend some time, before we go back to phone calls, on Eleanor's very deep interest and early interest in race relations, inequality, her time with the Tuskegee Airmen, her work on anti-lynching bill. Where did that come from, that avid interest? Because obviously it wasn't something that a lot of people shared, including a lot of people in government, and she probably did so at some risk to herself.
Well, I think, you know, she really believed that the U.S. couldn't be the leader of the democratic world until it dealt with its own racial bigotry, its own domestic, as she called it, its domestic sloth. And in the 30s, she becomes friends with Dr. Pauli Murray, the African-American poet, activist, teacher, and priest, who she called a firebrand. She's very close to Mary McLeod Bethune, who's head of the, you know, so many groups. She's head of the Black Cabinet. She's head of the Women's African American Women's League, and she's very close to Mary McLeod Bethune, who is the headmistress of a school in Florida that Eleanor Roosevelt supports. And she really does believe that integration has to come. In 1934, and this is in Volume 2, in 1934, May 11th, she makes a speech when the Educators of America pass a resolution condemning segregation. And it's really in very familiar language. It sounds almost like Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, 1954 Supreme Court. With segregation, terrible things happen. Black children are encouraged to feel inferior. White children are encouraged to feel superior. And it destroys all hope of community. Eleanor Roosevelt strides upon the stage and gives an incredible speech in which she concludes, "Let's deal with how stupid we have been. We must educate all of our children. Excellent, quality, free, public education." Mm. And then she concludes this great speech with the words, "Let's recognize that we will all go ahead together, or we will all go down together." Mm-hmm. And that's 1934 on. The world is fighting fascism, and the U.S. is fighting fascism with a segregated situation, which Eleanor Roosevelt opposes to the end of her life.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Tuskegee Airmen, how she found them, how she championed them, and how she got them.
That's kind of a wonderful story.
It is, really.
Yeah. She flies. She goes into a plane with a Tuskegee Airman, and she is photographed all over, you know, smiling and happy. These are great pilots. And she flies with the Tuskegee Airmen. She champions them. She insists that there be not only Tuskegee Airmen, but women in the military, black and white women in the military, with equal rank and equal pay. And she really is a champion for the Tuskegee Airmen, for the various women and men of color in every single military space.
Go ahead, please.
And then, you know, there's a scene in the book that gets a lot of attention. She goes into a segregated canteen, and she sees a black soldier munching on, you know, an ice cream cone.
Yes.
And she says, "May I have a bite of that?" She takes from his hand, she takes a bite, hands it back to him, and says, "See, that didn't hurt at all, did it?" And, you know, this is the kind of thing that she did that received a tremendous amount of attention. The Klan hated her. John Edgar Hoover, or J. Edgar Comey, as he is now known, the head of the FBI, really hated Eleanor Roosevelt, and her FBI file, which goes on for over 5,000 pages, is everything she says against lynching, against segregation, against discrimination. It's about 80 to 90% of her file.
Mm. So why was her husband reluctant to take up some of the same issues? Could he not progress politically if he embraced what she embraced?
Well, he felt, perhaps correctly, that he wouldn't have gotten his legislation passed at the time. He wouldn't have gotten his military expenditures. He wouldn't have gotten his defense structures if the Dixiecrats all opposed him, since they dominated. They and the isolationist Republicans dominated Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So he was more silent.
Mm-hmm.
But he never silenced her when it came to race.
Her leaving the DAR, she resigned. Why?
The DAR refused to let Marian Anderson, the world's greatest soprano, who had just come back from a global tour, she was so highly acclaimed, sing at Constitution Hall, which the DAR sort of owned. And so Eleanor Roosevelt said, if the DAR wouldn't let her sing, she would resign. And Marian Anderson then had this incredible Easter Sunday concert in front of the Lincoln Memorial. 75,000 Americans came to that splendid concert, which, of course, has been videoed and celebrated from that time to this.
And what did Marian Anderson have to say to Eleanor Roosevelt about that?
Well, Marian Anderson really was a great fan of Eleanor Roosevelt, and she really called her the first lady, you know, of decency and justice. But you're looking for a very specific answer. I'm not sure which.
Oh, no. It doesn't have to be specific. I was just thinking about, and I don't have that part of the book in front of me, but I was interested in reading about how she said such wonderful things about her, that Marian said wonderful things about Eleanor. Let's welcome more phone calls. 800-486-8655. The third volume, The War Years and Beyond Until Her Death in 1962. Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 62. Blanche Wiesen-Cook is our guest, and she is the author of all three of those. And let us go next to Sarah in Palmyra. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Sarah.
This is just so interesting. My husband and I actually named our 7.5-month-old daughter after Eleanor Roosevelt because we just are so inspired by her life. And in listening to this conversation, I just wanted to ask your guest if, as our Eleanor grows and she's becoming old enough to start hearing these stories, what do you think is the most important thing from Eleanor Roosevelt's legacy that we should begin to share with her?
Well, that's such a wonderful question.
Yes.
I think her whole life was one of growing and changing, and Eleanor Roosevelt never stopped growing and changing. And she went around the country and around the world asking people only two questions. She never told them what she thought. She always asked, tell me, what do you want? What do you need? And that was her commitment. There's a wonderful British woman, lady. I'm going to forget her name. Anyway, a very close friend of Eleanor Roosevelt who said that her first love was the people. She really existed to make life better for all people. And I think that's the message that we have for the future. She also... I dedicated my book, if I read the dedication.
Yes, please.
This book is dedicated to all those activists and agitators who resist tyranny, challenge authority, fight for peace, freedom, and human rights as we continue our journey for one world, no borders, no boundaries, no walls. And that was Eleanor Roosevelt's vision. And at some point, I mean, it's Wendell Willkie, who runs against FDR in 1940, and they become great friends. And then FDR sends Willkie around the world, and he has this epiphany, which is everything that happens anywhere affects everybody, everywhere. We are all connected, one world. Hmm. And Eleanor Roosevelt was very moved by Wendell Willkie's book. She read it, she quoted from it, she used it, and that became her mantra as well.
Oh, you're going to have so many stories to tell your daughter, Joanne,
yes.
Aren't you?
No doubt.
No doubt. You know, get the books.
And she was a great union. There's a wonderful book called She Was One of Us, Eleanor Roosevelt, the great union leader, who inspired women in unions. And, of course, we need you in Wisconsin have had a great union-crushing event.
Mm.
And Eleanor Roosevelt said, you know, workers need to protect each other and be protected. Unions do that. And so, you know, there's... But the biggest thing for me, long before Bernie Sanders called for free public higher education, in 1943, Eleanor Roosevelt said, everybody needs to have training and education, and we should have free public higher education all over this country, 1943 on.
Hmm.
And, of course, if everybody had training and education and jobs and health care and housing, it would be a different place.
Have fun with your daughter, Joanne.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. And let's spend some more time talking about it, because Joanne brought up her daughter, Eleanor's great love of young people and the American Youth Committee. Was that the name of it, Blanche, that she met with so
regularly?
American
Youth Congress.
Congress, yes. And was so inspired, yes, by it as well.
Right. Well, I mean, there were these wonderful young people who, you know, who disagreed and who were blunt and who lobbied and petitioned and were activists. Some of them were rude to FDR, which she just didn't like and was disappointed that they were rude. But they were the visionaries, and she became close to them, and they gave her hope as they moved forward. And, you know, to the end of her life, she was a supporter of student movements, so that I was student body president of Hunter College in 1961, and Eleanor Roosevelt, I invited her to speak, and she electrified the room in Roosevelt House where she did speak, and she told us to go south for freedom. So we took two buses to the segregated of North Carolina and had a real learning experience and sat in and, you know, did our part to help integrate what was still a very segregated country in the 1960s.
We are indeed. Let's talk about the relationship with the Jewish community in this country and her relationship as the years went on. It seems as though this was a very difficult issue. Maybe she grew in this, or maybe she was just trying to appease some friends of hers who were anti-Semitic. Where did she stand? You tell many stories in the book of FDR being very careful about his nomination to the Supreme Court, where he put Frankfurter on the court, but he really wanted Brandeis to die because he didn't want two Jews on the court. They were called Jews and communists, the Jew deal, etc. There was a lot of anti-Semitic thought, feeling going on in this country. Where did both of them stand? Were there traces of anti-Semitic thought on Eleanor's part, on Franklin's part?
Well, I think that in terms of Eleanor Roosevelt, she really grew out of a kind of bigotry that she wrote most clearly to her mother-in-law, Sarah Delano Roosevelt. She wrote, the Jew Party was appalling in the 1920s. And in 1939, she has a friend who she went to Allenswood with, and she writes her a terrible letter, an incomprehensible letter, attacking. Her friend was a Hitlerian, and she criticizes that, but says, you know, Jews should be, you know, they shouldn't get so much privilege and have so much, and it's a very strange letter. By the 40s, that completely changes, and she realizes that, like racism, anti-Semitism is just a pernicious fraud, and her own friendships grow with various Jewish people, including Jolash. But it's really interesting, the casual anti-Semitism and the casual racism in so much of her own circle, like Marion Dickerman and Nancy Cook. They can't stand her new friends because they are these young, you know, bold-speaking Jewish kids, and that's the beginning of the end of their friendship. And then Hick doesn't like her new radical friends, and that, of course, is an ongoing burden. But it really, you know, we all have to deal with the bigotry that's just endemic in our country and in our culture, so that Eleanor Roosevelt deals with it all the time. She becomes particularly close to Bernard Baruch, who is a financier, who is a primary target for anti-Semitism, and who's, you know, and I tell there about their friendship. But when FDR dies, Bernard Baruch proposes marriage And Eleanor Roosevelt writes to a friend, "Have you heard? Bernie has proposed marriage. Isn't that controlling?" But they're very, you know, they're very close. And all of her friends are, you know, a potpourri of everything. And she just completely grows into, you know, the kind of global vision that enables her to go to the UN, speak several languages, which she does,
right,
and become the first lady of the world and a healing powerhouse in global politics.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. We're talking about Eleanor Roosevelt this hour of the program. Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After. It's volume three of the biography from Blanche Beeson Cook, who is our guest this hour. And it's 1939 to 1962. So it's a very difficult and fascinating period in American history. And it focuses on, well, all kinds of issues because her life was all over the place and she was involved in so many different causes. But those were the war years, and those were also the times of exploding race relations in the country. So she spends a lot of time on those particular issues in addition to others. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is @KDunnShow, and this is the Ideas Network.
I'm speaking to you tonight at a very serious moment in our history. The Cabinet is convening and the leaders in Congress are meeting with the President. The State Department and Army and Navy officials have been with the President all afternoon. In fact, the Japanese ambassador was talking to the President at the very time that Japan's airships were bombing our citizens in Hawaii and the Philippines, and sinking one of our transports loaded with lumber on its way to Hawaii. By tomorrow morning, the members of Congress will have a full report and be ready for action.
Eleanor Roosevelt on December 7th, 1941. A lot of the book, and we haven't even gotten to very much of this, Blanche, concerns the war and an isolationist feeling in the United States and her tireless work on behalf of refugees and her concerns for people who are languishing in all kinds of places in the world. What a difficult time for everybody.
Well, it really was. And she was the first lady of radio. That's a great...
Yes.
She is the first one to go on the air after the bombing of Pearl Harbor happened. And then when it comes to the Japanese internment, she opposes it. She goes to the Gila camp, and she suggests that all the young people who want to go to college, who are in the camp, be allowed to go to college. She gets universities and colleges all over the country to admit the Japanese who are interned, and there is also a very, you know, wonderful Japanese military brigade that she helps to initiate, and it's one of the most bemedaled of all, and Eleanor Roosevelt does that, but although she's horrified by the Japanese internment of all of the, you know, loyal Japanese U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm. And she also has to deal with her family members who were in the war, and that weighs heavy.
Yes, for her four sons, all of them in uniform. And so Eleanor Roosevelt went around the country and around the world, really her heart for every mother's son, her heart for every mother, and her great trips to war zones, to London when it's under bombardment, to the Pacific when it, too, is under bombardment. I mean, she's really incredibly courageous and incredibly humanitarian.
Mary, an next caller in Milwaukee. Hello, Mary.
Hello. Well, first of all, I'd just like to say that I think Eleanor Roosevelt was a woman who was far ahead of her time. And I'm just wondering how she would feel about having Donald Trump as a president. I mean, we've gone from the greatness first lady of Eleanor Roosevelt to who knows what we're going to get with Ivanka Trump, so...
It's actually Melania.
Oh, well. Or whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, I have no idea. Some people have asked me, what would Eleanor Roosevelt say? And I think she might start by saying, well, let me tell you, little man, I don't think you know very much about our people. I feel like I should do a skit But I haven't done it. The real horror is Eleanor Roosevelt believed that all of our citizens, all of our residents needed to be helped, needed to have education, jobs, housing, security. And it's the opposite, the absolute complete opposite of what we have with this putsch that we've had. It's a stolen election. We now know that Hillary Clinton got over 2 million more votes than he did. And then it's just an astonishing situation, really. But I think what we have to deal with is we need a new New Deal. We need all kinds of support for the people who are out of work and who have lost. Many people have lost their homes. This is a nightmare. So, and Eleanor Roosevelt would certainly not stand where this new president stands, but she would really try to tutor him about what is really needed, which is work, jobs, security, education, health, housing for everybody. The United States is, by the way, the only industrial country without a national health care plan with single payer, which Eleanor Roosevelt and her friend Esther Lape, L-A-P-E, fought for from 1935 until Lape's death in 1982 at the age of 100. It was supposed to be in the 1935 Social Security Act, and the AMA lobbied it to death. Hmm. And now you have, for the first time, many physicians saying what we need is single payer. But, you know, they need to organize as well as the people to really get what is needed.
Thank you, Mary, very much for your call. We go to Jeff in Dorchester. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon. Just real quickly, this is why I listen to public radio. This is just amazing. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
My question is this. I think there is a quote attributed to Eleanor Roosevelt regarding doing the thing you fear the most.
You must do the thing you fear the most. Yes.
That is it. Now, can you offer anything up about the correlation to that and whatever time of life she might have been in? Because obviously she went through a lot of personal crises, and I wonder if she could make inspiration like that for herself. I mean, it's the depth. It amazes me.
Well, the very first time she says that or she relates to having said that is when she's hiking with her father. And she is afraid to go down a mountain, and he encourages her. And I think it's her father, or maybe it's T.R., her uncle, who says, you must do the thing you fear the most. And when she does it, she's delighted. So she's, you know, she's this great hiker. She rides horses. She wakes up every morning and does her exercises to the radio. And that became her mantra. Along with courage can be as contagious as fear. Thank you for that question.
Yes, thank you so much. Helen Sands, we have about a minute left. She was a student at City College of New York around 1943, and it was a free school, city-based kids. If she remembers correctly, Eleanor talked about India. Does that sound like the right timing for that issue? She says she was a total inspiration to young women about 25 years before second-wave feminism.
It was, because there was the Indian, you know, I mean, the Gandhi movement. Eleanor Roosevelt was in favor of freedom for India, independence for India. This is before she goes to India, but Gandhi and all of the Indian nationalists are in prison. Eleanor Roosevelt protests. It's one of the things that FDR encourages her to be silent about, because Churchill absolutely refuses to help India, and then there is the terrible famine in India, which Churchill allows to happen and doesn't get any aid over the hump.
And we have to say goodbye at that point, Blanche. I'm sorry.
Oh.
The time has gone by. I love talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you'll give me that guy's email?
Yes. We'll get it right now. Okay. Zeb will hear that. Thank you. Eleanor Roosevelt is the book, The War Years and After 1939 to 1962. Thanks to KP Whaley and Zeb.